Bye-bye.
Hello, everyone. This is Bob Marley's Ghost, broadcasting another radio show over the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain of the corporate media. We here at KQRP 106.1 FM see ourselves as being akin to Radio Free Europe and the Voice of America. We are here for radio listeners who are seeking broader, more accurate news and commentary on current world and local events. We, like television's Free Link, Free Speech TV, and Link channels, seek to bring a greater understanding of the war in Iraq, corporate crime, the religious rights agenda, the current administration's assault on the Bill of Rights, graft, corruption, and inefficiency by corporations like Halliburton, and other issues with which we as Americans must deal. This is Democracy in Action. I start my show out basically the same each time because I'm hoping to have new listeners who haven't heard this before. But if you heard it before, it's a good reinforcement. We here at KQRP 106.1 FM, South Ripon, Salida, and North Modesto promote a progressive agenda for America. We are pro-labor, for nationalized health care for every citizen, for campaign reform that eliminates the purchase of legislators by lobbyists, for quality free public education for all of our children, for environmental protection, for worldwide nuclear disarmament, for human rights, for the democratic process, for peaceful negotiated solutions to world problems, for the right to choose, for fair and equal protection under the law, for fair world trade practices, for fair world monetary practices, and for open dialogue about solutions to the problems our nation faces. In the past, progressive efforts have resulted in such things as protection of children in the labor force, reduction of occupational hazards, compensation for injured workers, health benefits provided by employers, protection of the environment, fair labor contracts, the 8-hour workday, overtime pay, paid sick leave and paid vacations, equal opportunity employment practices, protection from sexual harassment in the workplace, minimum wage laws, protection from unfair censorship, unemployment compensation, Social Security, Medicare, and many other socially responsible programs and actions. If you enjoy any of these protections and benefits, thank a liberal. Businesses surely did not suggest these positive benefits and currently seek to remove many of them, as most of you know. Again, we are KQRP 106.1 FM, broadcasting to Salida, South Ripon, and North Modesto. And again, we're like Radio Free and Free Radio KQRP. If you like what you hear here, tell a friend. Again, I'm Bob Marley's Ghost, and I'm your host for this program. Today's program topics include the healthcare crisis in America and some examples of that, some facts about the healthcare crisis, and some suggested solutions. I'm going to talk a little bit about drug safety and the FDA, the Patriot Act and the FBI abuse of powers using the Patriot Act, the Iraq War and other issues related to the Middle East, veterans' health care and compensation issues, the new Twinkie defense, the drug war, teens attacking the homeless, high-end beds, and history you may not know. Let's start out with the health care concerns that most Americans have right now. Did you know that half of all personal bankruptcies and a third of all credit card debt, and this is especially true for the elderly, are caused by illness or medical bills? Did you know that from 2000 to 2006, healthcare premiums went up 86%, while workers' adjusted income went up 15%? Did you know that over 30% of every private insurance healthcare dollar goes to administrative costs, compared to 3.2% for administrative costs in the Medicare program? Did you know that we pay 30 to 60% more for our prescription drugs here in the United States than any other modern industrialized nation in the world? These facts may shock you. I got these facts. My source was the California Nurses Association website on the internet, and those facts are from March 2007. Now, here are a few other questions and concerns and bits of information about our health care crisis. A poll was taken and was reported in the ARP monthly bulletin, and here were the questions that were asked. First of all, have you ever been without health care coverage? Overall, in other words, for everybody, 45% answered yes, and for those 50 and over, 35% answered yes. 53% answered no overall, and 64% in the 50 plus group answered no. In the don't know category, overall 1%, and the 50 plus was less than 0.5%. Now, these next questions, answer these in your head and see if you get the accurate answer to them. Question or statement: most of the uninsured do not have health insurance because they aren't working and have no access to employee health benefits. Did you answer true or false or don't know? Well, here are the answers of the American public who were polled on this question. 56% said true, 41% said false, and 2% did not know. The correct answer is false. That is not true. It's not true that most of the people who are uninsured are not working. That might surprise you. Second statement: most of the uninsured are new immigrants in the U.S. less than 6 years and are not U.S. citizens. True or false, or don't know? The public answered 44% true, 51% false, and 4% said they did not know. The correct answer is that that's false. Many people mistakenly believe that the new immigrants are the ones who add so much to the health care costs and are mostly uninsured. Third statement: the percentage of Americans who have health insurance provided by their employers has increased since 2000. The public said true 43%, false 55%, and didn't know 3%. The correct answer is false. How did you do? You may have found out something that you didn't know there. Here are some stark realities of U.S. health care coverage. About 18,000 people a year die prematurely because they lack health insurance. People file for bankruptcy at a rate of 1 every 30 seconds because of medical bills. Isn't that astounding? The average employer-based family premium rose 87% from 2000 to 2006 to $11,500. That's per year. Fewer than 60% of people under 65 have employer coverage, down from 70% in 1987. So over time, fewer and fewer employees are providing health care coverage for their employees, and they're making them pay more for the coverage that they do have. Question: could you lose your insurance? You can lose your job-based coverage if you're laid off, your spouse whose plan at work covers you dies, you and your insured spouse divorce, your parents' policy no longer covers you. You can lose your individual policy if the rates become unaffordable, you are pre-approved for major treatment, but after you've had it, the insurance cuts you off and refuses to pay. You can be not denied coverage if you have a health condition, you take a drug that prevents disease but suggests an underlying condition, your occupation is considered high risk, your records show treatment long ago for a condition that was minor, misdiagnosed, or a clerical error. Now, we're going to mention a couple of examples here in a little bit of how people lost or could not get coverage for those very reasons. But first, I'd like to share a statement of the AFL-CIO Executive Council on Healthcare. And they say, the nation is once again focused on the crisis in healthcare, and the American people are looking for a comprehensive solution instead of the inaction and incredibly ineffective piecemeal approach of the past 10 years. Nearly 47 million U.S. citizens are uninsured. Tens of millions more worry about losing the coverage they have. Workers fear changing or losing jobs because they are at risk of losing their health care coverage. American businesses that provide adequate health benefits are at a significant disadvantage, competing in the global marketplace with foreign companies that do not carry health care costs on their balance sheets. The same is true of businesses in domestic competition against employers that provide little or no coverage. As a society, we all benefit from improvements in public health. We are a more creative, vibrant, productive, and democratic nation because of it. We are all at risk for illness, injury, or poor health, and we all suffer when individuals are denied needed care. The shortcomings of the American healthcare system, which ignores these fundamental realities, strain our nation's social and economic fabric. The time for talking about this crisis is past. All families deserve the security of a universal health care system that guarantees access based on need rather than income. Health care is a fundamental human right and an important measure of social justice. We need single-payer health care in this country, and in California, the governor is trying to put together a package between employers, businesses, the health insurance companies, and the state to provide care for everyone in the state. However, anytime you mix in private insurance, you're mixing in health care for profit entities, and that's going to drive up the health care costs, and most likely, many cases, is not going to function as effectively as it should. They have an interest in keeping their high profits going and picking up that 30% of administrative costs for every dollar of health care that they provide, health care insurance that they provide. So they're not going to let us do something that doesn't involve giving them their profits. Well, H.R. 676, the United States National Health Insurance Act, has been endorsed by more than 240 union organizations in 40 states, including 17 state AFL-CIOs and 61 central labor councils and area labor federations. Why? Most strikes are caused by employer attempts to reduce or eliminate health care benefits. Fewer than 60% of employees and barely half of small employers now provide health insurance. The number is rapidly falling. Employers are shifting health care costs to employees through higher premiums, deductibles, co-pays, caps on services, and reduction in coverage. Workers now pay over 25% of the cost of employer-based plans. More employers are making hiring decisions based on health care conditions of applicants. Insurance plans restrict workers' choices of doctors and prescription drugs. Workers' compensation programs for on-the-job injuries are being slashed. More than 60% of people without health care have jobs. Half of all personal bankruptcies and 30% of credit card debt are due to medical bills. And that's something that I mentioned before. Just to give you some examples of how we are affected, there was an article in the local newspaper titled "Insurers Denial Hitting Children." And it talks about a Modesto man who sought coverage for his son and was rejected because the son had had an ear infection. He has a 15-month-old boy, and he eventually got enough money through his employment to try to purchase insurance, and he tried to buy insurance called HealthNet Simple Choice 15 plan, and was denied because his son had had an ear infection. Now, how many children don't have hearing ear infections? And anyway, then it was sort of shocking to him to find out that he could not get insurance that covered his child. The explanation by the insurance company is, and I quote, "It was standard policy." It's standard policy for them to deny health insurance to somebody who's had a condition even like an ear infection, an earache. Imagine the problems that you're going to have when you reach retirement, and about 99% of people at that time have had some kind of pre-existing health condition. And what are you going to do then when you go to buy supplemental insurance and they say, oh, sorry, we're not going to insure you because you had da-da-da-da-da. Well, you may be young right now and you think, oh, that's way off in the future. I don't have to worry about that. Well, you better start worrying about it because you'll be there someday, a lot sooner than you think. AARP is doing a campaign called Divided We Fail, discussing the issue of health care and health benefits in this country. And they are seeking examples from people to write in to the ARP magazine and tell them about problems that they've had with their health insurance and health problems. And here are just a couple. Lucy P. from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania writes, "I'm aware that Social Security was not meant to be the only income source we needed for retirement, but now that they are saying that it will run out within my lifetime is very disturbing. I am 60 this year and will probably have to work the rest of my life to support myself, having gone through life changes that depleted my savings. I have an IRA, but due to a job loss last year and an income drop of $7,000, it is hard to find the extra money to save. I feel very disappointed that I wasn't a better planner. Regardless, having to pay into Social Security so long is very upsetting to hear that it might not be there when I need it. Not only that, but she'll be needing some health care that may not be there." A second, Helen C. from Hazlitt, New Jersey, and I quote, "My name is Helene. I am 58 years old. 3 months ago, I was laid off my job and lost my medical benefits. I am currently collecting unemployment, and my husband is a contractor. His business is very slow, and at times he has no work. I am currently paying for COBRA, which is purchasing health insurance from a previous employer, and it takes up half of my unemployment check. I have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and am borderline diabetic. I have been looking for a job, and as of now, nothing has been offered to me. I have been on lots of interviews, but I believe my age may be working against me. I am terrified that when my unemployment insurance runs out, I will have to go without medical insurance." Does that sound familiar? Do you have any friends or do you know anyone who is struggling with concerns about their health insurance, whether it be while they're young, middle-aged, or as they approach retirement? Chances are we all know someone like that. Moving on, the issue of drug safety standards in this country is becoming somewhat more of an issue, and there's a reason for it. It seems that the drug safety promised by the FDA is lacking. And here is some information in that regard. Buyers beware. Drug manufacturers failed to conduct 71% of the latest safety tests they promised to perform on approved prescription drugs now on the U.S. market. In other words, they're out there without complete testing to see that they're safe. That figure, released last month, comes from the Food and Drug Administration, an agency increasingly under fire for being an ineffectual drug safety watchdog. And why would that be? Most likely because this administration has restricted the FDA in many cases and has cut their funding. Again, I quote, "FDA policy allows approval of some drugs even though questions linger about their efficacy and safety if the manufacturer promises follow-up tests once the new drug is on the market. These post-marketing tests, which the FDA has no power to force companies to complete, are key to determining whether an approved drug causes side effects when used over time. Well, many manufacturers haven't kept their word. The latest FDA report shows that 899 of the pending 1,259 studies drug makers promised to carry out on drugs now on the market had not been launched as of last fall. That's an increase of about 5% over the previous year. How can the FDA claim it's committed to improving drug safety when it can't even get drug makers to do the studies that they promise? If they have no power to enforce the FDA regulations, how can they be effective? And if they don't have those people out in the field making sure that drug manufacturers are doing the tests that they promised, how are they going to get them to do it? If it's like, hey, do it if you want to, in most cases they're not going to do it because that adds to the cost of the drug, the research to find out what the side effects are that might be fatal, such as there was a antifungal drug used for the nails, especially the toenails, which caused heart problems, and they didn't know that for a long time. And unfortunately, they found out after a number of people had suffered from taking the drug. Moving on, the Patriot Act and the FBI's abuse of powers. There was a recent article in the local paper indicating that, and I quote, "The FBI didn't deliberately break the law by improperly obtaining thousands of Americans' phone, email, and financial records," Director Robert Mueller told the Senate Judiciary Committee. That was good. That was the good news. But then came the sad, or the bad. "It happened," Mueller said, "because of mistakes, carelessness, confusion, lack of training, lack of guidance, and lack of adequate oversight by the FBI. The director accepted responsibility for that. Yahoo, what's the penalty to him? I won't let it happen again." I mean, the FBI director sounds like Don Knotts in The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. If he cannot manage his department on such issues of importance to Americans, our privacy, from government agencies snooping into our personal business, even if we have nothing to hide, and most of us have nothing to hide, but they still snoop. Does that bother you? That's Big Brother government. We're watching you. Hey, I have nothing against looking in the files of those who are highly suspect because of their behavior to see if there's any risk to America and Americans. But to just willy-nilly go and look at people's files because they think it's a good idea is ridiculous to me. I wonder how you feel. By the way, if you have questions or comments or concerns about issues discussed on this show, Bob Marley's Ghost, at 106.1 FM, KQRP Salida, and KQRP.com on the internet. I want to remind everybody that we are on the internet at KQRP.com. If you have those questions, concerns, comments about the show or whatever, you can send them care of Bob Marley's Ghost, P.O. Box 612, Salida, California, 95368. Let me repeat that. Send your concerns, questions, comments about the show to Care of Bob Marley's Ghost, P.O. Box 612, Salida, California, 95368. I'll try to remember to repeat that at the end of the show today. Moving on to the Iraq War and problems in the Middle East. I have a variety of items to discuss here. The first being Bush blasted his critics, and this was in the newspaper, saying this: "Congressional critics of President Bush's Iraq policy, quote, seem to be rooting for failure," former White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card said Tuesday. Card said in an interview that lawmakers' efforts to mandate withdrawal timelines and threats to cut funding go beyond the scope of their duties. He blamed critics in both parties for putting a negative slant on the war. Quote, "We should be rooting for success," Card said. "I'm very upset that I see many of his critics who are partisans, Republicans or Democrats, who seem to be rooting for failure. You know, they don't like his plan, therefore they want it to fail." Hogwash. What a crock. It seems to me to be ridiculous. Do they not know what happened in the last election? It seems to me America sent a message to this administration saying, look, we're tired of your failed policies in the Middle East. Try something new. More of the same is expecting a different result is a lot like insanity. And we would like the insanity of this current war to end. And besides, anyone who's ever played on a sports team, take for example football, if you're playing in, say, and the quarterback calls a play to hand the ball off to a halfback going and you're blocking for him, the fact that you do not like the play doesn't mean you don't block. Maybe the next play will be better, but again, if the same play is called time and again by the quarterback and it doesn't work, eventually you mention it to the quarterback and hope that he changes his play calling. That's what we're asking for in Iraq. Nothing more, nothing less. Is that ridiculous? I don't think so. On the issue of Nancy Pelosi going to Syria, Bush said, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's meeting with Syrian President Bashar Assad, like earlier meetings with Assad by Republicans, Democrats, and Europeans, sent mixed signals that enhanced Assad's legitimacy even though Syria sponsored terrorism. The world would be better served by working in concert to change Assad's behavior than by sending visiting delegations, Bush said. Well, if they are a terror-sponsoring nation, and in previous comments, President Bush has said that we will go after terrorists wherever you are, why aren't we in Syria right now rooting those terrorists out? It seems to me that we really need to be talking with some of these countries that possibly are supporting terrorists and working with them to reduce the risks of that, to find out the reasons behind the terrorism and to try to ameliorate them so that we have fewer terrorists, not more. Here's another one that kind of, you know, it stuns me or dumbfounds me. And this was an article that was talking about what the United States is demanding of the government of Iraq. And listen to this. U.S. officials have told the hardline Shiite Muslim prime minister that they want an Iraqi government in place by year's end, acceptable to the country's Sunni Arab neighbors, particularly Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt. They have said it must be secular and inclusive, one of al-Maliki's associates said. How is it that we demand that Iraq's government be secular while we seek to make our government a Christian government? Is that not hypocritical to say we want to incorporate Christianity and the concepts of Christianity in our government and prevent them from incorporating Islamic beliefs into theirs? It's absurd. It's hypocritical. It won't work. I read an article in the paper, in the local paper, which is titled Rumsfeld is Safe from Torture Case, talking about torture in Abu Ghraib. And I'm just going to quote a little section of it here and make a comment. It says, no matter how appealing it is, how appealing it might seem to use the courts to correct allegations of severe abuses of power, Hogan wrote, government officials are immune from such lawsuits. Additionally, foreigners held overseas are not normally afforded U.S. constitutional rights. Despite the horrifying torture allegations, Hogan said, no case law supported the lawsuit, which would bring Rumsfeld to account. Well, what about case law in the Nuremberg trials after World War II, where they tried those who were committing atrocities against the Jews during World War II? Is that not case law against torture and murder? You decide. I think that's case law myself. Another discussion here in terms of the funding for the Iraq War, a little bit of talk about that. And I read, the House of Representatives vote to give President Bush another $100 billion to continue the war in Iraq and Afghanistan is weak. The namby-pamby Democratic leadership of the House is trying to portray this bill as a positive step toward ending the war. And some organizations are saying the bill challenges the Bush administration's failed policy in Iraq and therefore should be supported by the anti-war movement. United for Peace and Justice strongly disagrees. We urge you to call your representative in the House now and tell them that you do not accept this bill as accountability. And that's the title of the bill, Iraq Accountability Act, that they passed, which is, as I said, it's an example of the namby-pamby Democratic Party leadership. They should take a much stronger stand against the war in Iraq and be more definitive in what they propose and what they legislate. Call your representatives. Give them this simple message. Say, bring our troops home now. Don't support bills like the Iraq Accountability Act that you passed because they don't have much teeth in them. Support military funding only for the safe withdrawal of the troops. That's what we want. That's what most Americans want. We want to bring our troops home safe. Not that we want to shrink from the issues of terrorism in the world. We just want better policies and procedures and strategies for dealing with it. We don't want to create more terrorists that we then have to fight. We want to reduce the number of terrorists and go after the terrorists who are the greatest threat. Not as we are doing in Iraq. What do you think? And again, the United States is flexing its military muscle in the Persian Gulf. I guess you all know that warships have been sent to the Middle East, into the Persian Gulf, to enforce the concept that America is ready to do something, if necessary, with Iran if they don't do what we think they should do. They've been doing warlike maneuvers in the Persian Gulf with 15 warships and more than 100 aircraft, and that just heightens tensions between our countries. Yes, the Prime Minister of Iraq, Ahmadinejad, is talking threateningly. Let's negotiate with him. Let's talk about how we can reduce the risks of war between our countries and how together we can bring some kind of peace and civility to the Middle East. We don't need to flex our muscles and rattle our sabers every time somebody says something that we don't like. There was an article in today's paper called Not Everyone in the World Longs to Be an American. It talks about a gentleman named Samuel Huntington's warning that we are entering a post-Cold War clash of civilizations. This is a Harvard professor who made this statement back in 1993, basically saying that there are 6 or 8 different cultures in the world right now who are vying for power, and that we need to understand those different cultures and understand, for example, that we're never going to change Islamists to be like us, and they're never going to change us to be like them. We need to let them know what our basic core values are, to understand their core basic values, and to see where we can find areas of agreement and work out areas of disagreement so that we don't have to end up in wars killing hundreds of thousands of them, or them killing thousands and thousands of us. So the basic premise here is not everybody in the world wants to be an American or be just like an American. We need to understand that. We need to base our policies on that understanding. His book is The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order, and it might be a good read or a good reread for those who haven't read it. Again, it's called The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order, and it's by Samuel Huntington, who's a Harvard professor. The article in the local paper was very, very interesting. It said, it finished with, although the United States never must shrink from defending itself and its legitimate interests, its citizens must understand that U.S. power is not unlimited. As the shattering Iraq experience proves, we cannot make people what they are not and what they do not wish to be. Many Muslims in Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle East wish to be Islamic. Embracing Western cultural forms and ideals would make them something other than Islamic. They get this. Why don't we? Moving on. Talking now about, briefly, about something called memory lapses. It seems that Scooter Libby, Jeff Grover, George W. Bush, and Attorney General Gonzalez are using the new, what I call the Twinkie defense. In other words, they're having memory lapses about what they've said and about what they've done. And it seems that these memory lapses, once someone shows them what they said or did previously, and they say, well, I don't remember that, or I don't recall that, seems to be a very, very weak defense of their policies and actions. I call it the new Twinkie defense. I don't remember. I don't know, or something. It just doesn't work. Now I want to talk a little bit about problems that we've been having taking care of our veterans. And I want to start with some information from a book called Bush on the Couch, by a gentleman named Justin A. Frank. He's a medical doctor and a psychiatrist. And here's what he says. He says, in the fall and winter of 2003, we saw Bush unleashing the false promise tease on one of his core constituencies, American combat veterans. On a visit to Walter Reed Medical Center in the week before Christmas to look after his own medical needs, Bush came across a group of veterans to whom he claimed a commitment to provide excellent health care to anybody who is injured on the battlefield. These men and women were soldiers in the war on terrorism, on which Bush has staked his presidency and the reputation of our nation. And yet for months, Bush's promises had been belied by reports of shoddy treatment coming out of the military's medical system. And this is back in 2003. Bush had opposed expansion of the Pentagon's health insurance system to include the National Guard and Reserve, and attempted to cut the budget for military family housing and medical facilities. The result, as UPI reported in October, was that, quote, hundreds of sick and wounded U.S. soldiers, including many who served in Iraq, are languishing in hot cement barracks here while they wait, sometimes for months, to see doctors. The National Guard and Army Reserve soldiers' living conditions are so substandard and the medical care so poor that many of them believe the Army is trying to push them out with reduced benefits for their ailments. And this is history all the way back to 2003, and Mr. President Bush always touts himself as someone who is a supporter and stands behind our soldiers and our veterans. Well, it doesn't appear to be so. Continuing, an Army Times editorial in the summer of 2003 exposed Bush's empty praise for the military. Quote, talk is cheap and getting cheaper by the day, judging from nickel and dime treatments the troops are getting lately. For example, the White House griped that various pay and benefits incentives added to the 2004 defense budget by Congress are wasteful and unnecessary, including a modest proposal to double the $6,000 gratuity paid to families of troops who die on active duty. That's what an American's life is worth to the family if they die while on military duty. $6,000. And they griped about doubling it to $12,000. Continuing. This comes at a time when Americans continue to die in Iraq at a rate of about one a day. The editorial contained numerous examples, including various cuts in funds for building and even for basic pay. Quote, taken piecemeal, all these corner-cutting moves might be viewed as mere flesh wounds, the editorial concluded. But even flesh wounds are fatal if you suffer enough of them. It adds up to a troubling pattern that eventually will hurt morale, especially if the current breakneck operation tempo also rolls on unchecked and the tense situation in Iraq and Afghanistan do not ease. And those statements were made back in 2003. Now to just continue on that topic, there was an article in the newspaper here locally titled Wounded Soldier Fights the Army. This is a California soldier, a sniper, shot him. His name is Sergeant Joe Bowman, and he is a Californian. And let me read from the article. A sniper shot Sergeant Joe Bowman on a Baghdad street on April 2005. The AK-47 round ripped through his midsection, ricocheted off his Kevlar vest, and shredded his abdomen. The bullet also ignited the tracer magazine on his belt, setting Bowman on fire. Pretty serious injuries. Almost 2 years later, the 22-year-old California National Guard soldier walks with a cane, suffers from back problems, and has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder that keeps him from sleeping and holding a job. He can't even go to the grocery store by himself, said his wife, Eileen, also 22. The question pending before a military review board here is whether to grant Bowman a military disability pension and health care or cut him an $8,000 check for his troubles. Now, he's going to have troubles the rest of his life, and they would cut him an $8,000 check for that, and they would fight and get in the way of him getting some kind of disability pension? What kind of backing of your military is that, Mr. President? Well, continuing. In a tense bureaucratic triage faced by thousands of wounded U.S. soldiers as they negotiate their way back to civilian life, if they are rejected by the military disability system, they can try their luck with the overwhelmed Department of Public Affairs, or Department of Veteran Affairs, excuse me, another lengthy process with uncertain results. A 2006 analysis by the General Accounting Office showed that for National Guard and Reserves, the process takes much longer and is less likely to result in full disability benefits. And now I read from an article on the internet published by the New York Times where they're talking about the same thing. And they're saying this, the percentage of claims pending for more than 180 days for these veterans are, in Washington State, 63.3% are pending. Over 180 days, that's a half a year. In Pittsburgh, 41.6% are pending and have been for over a year and a half. In Chicago, 41.8% are pending over 80 days. In Montgomery, Alabama, 41.2% are pending over 180 days. In New Orleans, 41.1% are pending over 180 days. Here's another example of what's happening to these young men and women. From the same article off the internet, it says, and I quote, Staff Sergeant Gregory O. Wilson from Texas National Guard waited nearly 2 years for his veteran's disability check after he was injured in Iraq. 2 years. If he had been an active duty soldier, he would have gotten more help in cutting through the red tape. Alan Curry of Chicago has fallen behind on his mortgage while waiting nearly 2 years for his disability check. If he had filed his claim in a state deploying fewer troops than Illinois, Mr. Curry, who was injured by a bomb blast when he was a staff sergeant in the Army Reserve in Iraq, would most likely have been paid sooner and gotten more in benefits. Veterans face serious inequities in compensation for disabilities depending on where they live and whether they were on active duty or members of the National Guard or the Reserve, an analysis of the New York Times has found. Those factors determine whether some soldiers wait nearly twice as long to get benefits from the Department of Veteran Affairs as others and collect less money, according to agency figures. Many new veterans say they are often left waiting for months or years, wondering if they will be taken care of. Unable to work because of post-traumatic stress disorder and back injuries from a bomb blast in Iraq in 2004, Specialist James Webb of the Army ran out of savings while waiting 11 months for his claim. In the fall of 2005, Mr. Webb said he began living on the streets in Decatur, Georgia, a state that has the 10th largest backlog of claims in the country. Quote, I should have just gone home to be with the family instead of trying to do it on my own, said Mr. Webb, who received a Bronze Star for his service in Iraq. But with the post-traumatic stress disorder, I just didn't want any relationships. After waiting 11 months, he began receiving his $869 monthly disability check, and he moved into a house in Newman, Georgia. About 3 weeks ago, Mr. Webb moved back home to live with his parents in Kingsport, Tennessee. This is how we take care of our honored and cherished veterans. $869 monthly disability check. How many of you out there can live on that? How many people anywhere can live on that except are in a third world country? And these are examples of the talk is cheap Bush administration. Oh, we love our veterans. We support our military. Yeah, right. Show it with your wallet, not your mouth. Moving on. Next comment. Relates to the war on drugs. There was an article in a local paper which suggests that the war on drugs is a failure, and more than anything, it's more like modern-day Jim Crow law, which prevented the blacks from the South from voting for many, many years. According to a 2006 report by the American Civil Liberties Union, blacks make up an estimated 15% of drug users but account for 37% of those arrested on drug charges, 59% of those convicted, and 74% of drug offenders sentenced to prison. The United States has 260,000 people in state prisons on nonviolent drug charges. 183,200, more than 70%, of them are black or Latino. And when you understand that once you have a felony, you cannot vote. That takes these people out of the voting population, and this is perhaps convenient for a certain party for which the blacks of this country are not noted for voting for. In any event, I conclude with a 2000 study found that 1.4 million black men, 13% of the black male population, were unable to vote in the 2000 election because state laws bar felons from the polls. In Florida, 1 in 3 black men is permanently disqualified from voting. First of all, we have lost the war on drugs. Face reality. We have lost the war on drugs. We need different approaches to solving the drug problem. And of course, you've got the circular argument of the countries who provide the drugs of saying, well, America, you need to reduce the demand for drugs. And of course, we shoot right back at them. You need to reduce the supply of drugs. Well, We can say that as long as we want to, but the truth of the matter is we need to change our drug policies in this country to take the long prison sentences out of people who are committing offenses which should not be counted as felonies, which put them in prison and really make criminals out of them. And for the conditions that quite often drive the poorer segments of our society to the sale and use of drugs. We need to re-examine those issues and find new policies and admit that the war on drugs in this country is a failure. Next topic. It's called Investing in Dreams. This one blew my mind when I saw it in the local newspaper. Did you know there are high-end beds being manufactured which cost up to $49,500? Yes, I said $49,500 for one bed. Should people be sleeping on $50,000 beds when we have thousands of people sleeping on the concrete in cities, or sleeping on the dirt or the ground or in some garbage dump, some dumpster? This is one of the most blatant, hey, look what I can afford types of things that I've seen. It's called conspicuous consumption. Hey, I can afford it. What a shame. I'm not saying that you can't get a new bed, but or a nice bed, but $49,500 for a bed? Does that seem logical? It blows my mind. Next topic. I've seen some articles and heard some news stories about boys who are beating up the homeless and in some cases killing them. And to me, that's a shame, especially since many of our homeless happen to be veterans of the Vietnam War, and now some veterans from the Iraq-Afghanistan war, and that upsets me a lot. I hope that something can be done to protect the people on the street from these criminal animals who attack them for no reason except for, in some cases, to have some fun beating them up with a baseball bat or their fists or kicking them or whatever. We need to do something to protect the homeless from that and to remove these young men from society. Now we're going to talk about history you may not know. And today's history comes from a book called 1001 Things Everyone Should Know About African American History, something many of us white people don't know much about. You get a little bit of it in your history book when they talk about the Civil War, or they might even talk about this civil liberties battles of the 60s and that type of thing, but you get very, very little real black history in school, in elementary school and high school, and oftentimes in college. In any event, this comes from the book that I mentioned about black history, and it's item number 575, and it's called The Significance of the Houston Riot. And I read, African Americans were not accepted in the Marines or as combat personnel in the Navy, which continued to confine African Americans to mess duty on ships. They're talking about World War II here. Even in the Army, black soldiers often received inadequate training, served in labor battalions, and languished under white officers who verbally and physically abused them. Perhaps the most negative aspect of joining the Army was the experience of being stationed in the South, where white communities often resented and tormented black troops from the North. In one instance, the constant abuse, goading, and beatings routinely endured by black regiments flared into a riot. After weeks of harassment, the 24th Infantry retaliated when one of its members, Corporal Charles W. Baltimore, was beaten, shot at, and then arrested by policemen in Houston for having the temerity to ask the policeman about another arrested member of the battalion. On the night of August 23rd, 1917, On the night of August 23rd, 1917, approximately 100 soldiers of the 24th marched on the town, opened fire on the police station, and killed 16 whites, including 5 policemen, and wounded several others. The army quickly court-martialed 63 of the soldiers, convicted and hanged 19 of them without appeal, and jailed another 67. Like the Brownsville affair, the punishment in the Houston riot divided African Americans and raised once again the question of the kind of justice that African American soldiers could expect from a military that refused to protect them from Southern attacks. Moreover, the Houston riot may have led Secretary of War Newton Baker to abandon plans to recruit 16 regiments of African Americans. He organized only 4. Second item here in Black history related to the war, and it talks about the 369th in France and welcomed home. It says the 369th was welcomed when it arrived in France early in 1918, World War I, since French forces were exhausted from years of battling the Germans. As part of the American Expeditionary Force, the 369th was attached to a French unit armed with French weapons, and thrown immediately into combat. Holding off the Germans at Bois de Hauza and fighting their way to the Rhine, the 369th recorded one of the most impressive records of any army regiment, never retreating and never surrendering any of its men to capture by the enemy. The Germans called them Blutliste Schwarze, bloodthirsty blacks. Because of their zealous fighting, the French saw them as saviors, and broke with the American Army's tradition of not rewarding black heroism by awarding 171 of them with the French Legion of Honor for their bravery. When they returned home to New York, they were given a hero's welcome as they marched down Fifth Avenue to confetti and applause. The U.S. Army tries to export racism. W.E.B. Du Bois located an official memorandum about how the U.S. Army advised the French to deal with African-American troops. And here it is. French military mission, stationed with the American Army, August 7, 1918. Secret information concerning black American troops. Conclusion. 1. We must prevent the rise of any pronounced degree of intimacy between French officers and black officers. We may be courteous and amiable with these last, but we cannot deal with them on the same plane as with white American officers without deeply wounding the latter. We must not eat with them, must not shake hands, or seek to talk or meet with them outside of the requirement of military service. 2. We must not commend too highly the black American troops, particularly in the presence of Americans. It is all right to recognize their good qualities and their services, but only in moderate terms, strictly in keeping with the truth. 3. Make a point of keeping the native cantonment population from spoiling the Negroes. Americans become greatly incensed at any public expression of intimacy between white women and black men. Familiarity on the part of white women with black men is furthermore a source of profound regret to our experienced colonials, who see it as an overwhelming menace to the prestige of the white race. Military authority cannot intervene directly in this question, but it can, through the civil authorities, exercise some influence on the population. Now, that was a memorandum to the French about the blacks fighting in World War I. So that's a little bit of the history you might not know. And we're coming to the end of today's show. Once again, I'd like to remind you that this is 106.1 FM, KQRP Salida, and KQRP.com on the internet. If you have questions, concerns, or comments about the show, Send them to care of Bob Marley's Ghost, P.O. Box 612, Salida, California 95368. That's Bob Marley's Ghost, P.O. Box 612, Salida, California 95368. And that's today's show. Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard here, tell a friend. If you didn't like what you heard here, tell a friend.